The next case is 05-1156, Disciplinary Counsel versus Jennifer Krieger Hughes. Mr. Berger.
May it please the court, Robert Berger for Leder, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. Honorable Chief Justice, I request to reserve 3 minutes time for rebuttal. Respondent Jennifer Krieger first met 16-year-old Bradley Willoughby when she was court-appointed to represent him as a public defender. After Willoughby was released from detention, respondent then commenced and continued a six-month-long romantic and sexual relationship with Willoughby. During this same time period, respondent was also the primary financial supporter of Willoughby for 9 months and provided Willoughby an estimated $8,000 in cars, housing, gifts, food, and clothing.
Mr. Berger, let me just clarify. I think maybe clear from the briefs, but none of the conduct that has brought her here occurred before the client reached 18. Is that correct? She began her relationship with him when he was 16, I think. But
Your Honor, Mr. Willoughby, when he was arrested for assaulting the respondent, alleged to the police that their sexual relationship had begun while he was a teenager, and that allegation is a part of the record.
Respondent, teenager to him would be, teenager can have different meanings to different people. I mean, is 16?
Well, I believe he said 15 or 16. Okay. Respondent denied that, and the board found that the relationship began after Willoughby was 18.
Counsel, there's a stipulation entered into by the respondent with respect to the activities. What the board penalty recommended is what?
The board recommended an 18-month state suspension.
And the conclusion of your brief simply says you think she should have some time out. So what is your recommendation?
Your Honor, we are requesting 24 months with 12 months stayed. And the basis for that recommendation is the 8 separate disciplinary rule violations, including the dishonesty, the aggravating factors of a selfish and dishonest motive, and the harm that occurred, as well as a lack of substantial mitigating evidence in the record.
And what is she doing now? Because when we take people out, and I assume the board is weighing that when they say a suspension or a stay on the imposition. When we take people out, if they're actively practicing, that has an impact on clients as well. So what is she doing now, or do you know?
Your Honor, at the hearing, she testified she was working for LexisNexis as a online researcher responding to questions over the telephone. Previously, she had also indicated that she was working as a waitress part-time. I don't know if that continues.
So no indication that, as we had not long ago, somebody who had a whole bunch of other clients who were going to be impacted. No indication of that here.
It's my understanding, after she resigned from the public defender's office in February of 2004, since that time she has not actually practiced law serving clients.
There's a lot more involved in this case than purely the sexual relationship. The fact that she purchased many items for him while she was representing him.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would suggest there are 3 categories of misconduct. The first is the six-month-long sexual relationship. The second is the $8,000 in financial assistance, which included co-signing a lease for an apartment and paying the rent for 6 months, purchasing 3 different vehicles, taking him along secretly on a family vacation and putting him up in a separate room, which she concealed from her husband and 2 children. And then finally, there is the dishonesty attached to all of this. When respondent's employer became aware that respondent had posted bond on a case in which another public defender was representing Mr. Willoughby, Respondent was called in to a meeting with her supervisor, the assistant public defender, and the public defender for Montgomery County. At that meeting, they mentioned to her, there are rumors that you're engaging in sexual misconduct with Mr. Willoughby. Respondent made misleading and deceptive statements to protect that relationship and preserve that relationship. She admitted she had provided some financial assistance. They verbally explained to her the impropriety of all of those actions. She left the meeting, resumed her sexual relationship, and resumed the financial support. That was in December of 2003.
While all of that is salacious and interesting, perhaps on one level, if he's 18 and he's not her client, then much of what you've just indicated wouldn't be a violation of anything.
Your Honor, during this time period.
Except, I mean, lying to her employer when confronted about it. But the actual activities with the young man, even though she's married, isn't a violation of anything, is it?
Well, Your Honor, during the time period, from the time Mr. Willoughby turned 18 in June of 2003 through December of 2003, not only was respondent engaging in the sexual relationship, providing the improper financial assistance, engaging in the dishonesty, she was also providing Willoughby free legal representation outside of what she did previously through the public defender. She provided free legal representation in seven separate matters. There were several cases in the Montgomery County Court. There were several hearings in the Miami County Court. In the Miami County Municipal Court. There were also two private legal issues that she assisted him in resolving. So throughout this period, she was also acting as his legal counsel.
Okay, and that's where she gets into the ethical thicket then.
That's correct, Your Honor. The combination of representing the client while at the same time providing financial assistance.
And I don't recall the time frame in which we became clearer about the prohibitions, and it's still a murky area because one can have an ongoing romantic relationship with someone that predates representation. And I mean, I don't know if we still have that all straightened out.
Respondent testified at the hearing that she knew it was improper to engage in a sexual relationship with a client and that she knew it was improper to provide financial assistance of that degree to a client.
And our articulation of those in some specific cases came before this.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
It is a fairly recent vintage that we began to talk about this, isn't it?
Certainly within the past 10 years.
Yeah.
Certainly. But respondent clearly indicated she knew the conduct was improper. Further, after she was advised of its impropriety, both orally in December of 2003 and then in writing by her employer in January 2004, she still continued the conduct unabated. She was going to maintain that relationship regardless of the consequences or regardless of what the rules required.
However, is there a way, in terms of trying to be more precise and helpful to lawyers, I assume we haven't gone so far as to say if you end the attorney-client relationship, you can't take up with a former client.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. In fact, in a recent case, this court decided, Disciplinary Counsel versus Freeman, the court held that it was presumptively unethical for an attorney to engage in sexual conduct with a client they were representing in a criminal matter. So I think the rule is, during the representation, there should be no.
And once the representation is clearly over,
That's correct, Your Honor.
We don't get involved.
That's the indication from this court's prior case law. There are actually four cases I would refer this court to as deciding elements and determining the appropriate sanction in this matter. The first one is Disciplinary Counsel versus Boer. Boer received a one-year suspension after he engaged in sexual activity with a client one time in a jail meeting room. This court held in its decision that whether a client initiates the sexual activity or simply consents to it, the burden is on the attorney to ensure that the attorney-client relationship remains on a professional level. The board, in hearing this matter, measured respondent's conduct against that standard and found in their decision respondent failed to meet the burden. Brewer received a one-year suspension for one act of sexual misconduct. Respondent's misconduct is more egregious and more extensive. In addition to the sexual activity with Mr. Willoughby, respondent also engaged in dishonesty and provided substantial financial assistance. I mentioned a moment ago, disciplinary counsel versus Freeman. Freeman received a six-month suspension for paying his 18-year-old client money to pose undressed, offering her alcohol, and soliciting her for sexual activity. Again, the misconduct in this matter by respondent is more egregious and more extensive. Unlike Freeman, respondent engaged in dishonesty and also provided substantial financial assistance. A case with some similarities to this matter is disciplinary counsel versus Cerencioni. Cerencioni represented a client and became romantically obsessed with that client. He then provided that client $11,000 worth of financial assistance and made dishonest statements to the court and to a landlord about his relationship with that client. As a result, Cerencioni received a one-year suspension with 6 months stayed. And this court, in its decision, observed that Cerencioni's sanction was substantially mitigated by his strong and extensive character evidence. Cerencioni submitted 26 character letters to this court and had testimony from numerous prominent citizens, a county commissioner, an appeals judge, a municipal court judge, a mayor, a city manager, a police chief, all of whom vouched for Cerencioni. There is no such outstanding character evidence in this matter that would mitigate against a more substantial suspension. In this matter, respondent engaged in improper sexual conduct with a client. She provided $8,000 in financial assistance to a client. She engaged in dishonesty and maintained and concealed this relationship, even though she knew from its beginning that it was improper and she had been advised by her employer that it was improper. As such, based upon the aggravating factors and her dishonesty, relator requests this court order an actual suspension from the practice of law of 24 months with 12 months stayed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Shane Gold.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Moyer. May it please the court. Jennifer Krieger is humbly before this court today. You've all had the benefit of reviewing, I'm sure, the stipulations which detail the relationship that developed between her and Mr. Willoughby. The board ultimately, from the facts and its conclusions, recommended a stayed suspension of 18 months, something which I feel is reasonable and appropriate. If you take a look at what happened here and accurately compare the facts here to what's happened in those few other cases where similar circumstances have been determined by this court. This all started with very innocent intentions. Mr. Willoughby was the aggressor. Ms. Krieger, unfortunately, let it happen. She lost her marriage. She lost her career. She almost lost her life as the victim of a criminal incident perpetrated by Mr. Willoughby, something for which he served time as a convicted felon. He's now out. She toils in a cubicle. She does have a few private clients, Justice Pfeiffer, in case you wanted to know that, or perhaps it was you, Chief Justice, that brought that up, but there are but a few. In taking a look at the cases that have been mentioned, let me start with Freeman, a case decided by this court just a few weeks ago. In Freeman, this court said that the attorney should have a six-month suspension. And in reaching the conclusion, something that was important here was that there was nothing in the way of contrition. If you take a look at the board's decision here, if you could have been there, this lady's been nothing but contrite. She feels horrible about what has come to pass.
Counsel, from reading the stipulations here, the only thing that really ended this relationship was the turn of events in February where an act of violence occurred.
That did bring it to its ultimate conclusion, but I take a look at it in the inception, and perhaps if you look at a flip side of Professor Higgins and Eliza Doolittle, this attorney thought that she had the ability to take a poor kid from the streets who'd known nothing but poverty and a hard life and to improve his life, to improve him. She saw some positive qualities that as he matured into a young adult with nurturing and assistance, she could make him a productive member of society. And in her zeal and not wanting to fail in what became a mission of sorts, she didn't know when to stop. And the result was tragic. But she didn't harm him. He made choices to return back to the lifestyle from whence he came.
Well, one harm to him is apparently the public defender's office will not represent him any longer. Is that accurate? I read that. Is that accurate?
I mean, he's lost
the ability to have a public defender represent him. With his record, he's going to need probably continued representation by someone.
He would probably have court-appointed counsel, and there'd be some minimal cost to the system.
And he was in our cases. One case we had with the vulnerability of the so-called client was a factor here. Let's begin it with 18. The relationship began before that, but she's the lawyer.
Yes.
And he's the 18-year-old client who is in trouble. And even if he began the relationship, how do we write this case to find no time out for her in view of all the other cases we've written where we've said you can't, I mean, she's got four violations of the code at least. What's the message to the bar if we say, well, everybody else, you take time out. But for her, with all this in this extended period of time, lying to her supervisor, taking advantage of a vulnerable young man. Obviously, he's streetwise. But how do we distinguish that sanction in this case from the sanctions in the other cases where the conduct arguably was not as severe as hers?
First of all, the board did not find that he was harmed. The board specifically found to the contrary.
And I guess I have to say to you, I don't understand the board's rationale in this case. I just don't. I mean, it's just to say he was not harmed. When she's giving him money, he's on drugs, she gives him money, she enables him to do everything. I mean, I'm sorry, I just don't understand the board. Usually I agree with the board, but I don't understand their rationale in this.
And
all the others were men. This is a woman. Perhaps that's the reason that she doesn't have the ability to put someone under duress as a man may have. I don't know, but I don't know how to explain the board's decision. Maybe somebody can, but I can't.
She emotionally succumbed to him, and in conjunction with her continued desire to help, this is what happened. I don't have a clear explanation of what happened.
She was in Las Vegas, and at that time, she wasn't representing him, and she talked with the public defender who was representing him and actually posted his bond.
Yes.
And that's really how this all came to light.
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Huelsman found out, and
I don't know that we're in the 21st century, and it bothers me to think we're talking about a damsel in distress and that a man is taking advantage of her. I think we've reached the point where women are standing on equal footing with men in these situations. All you have to do is watch Sex and the City, and you know that women certainly can take care of themselves.
What time is that on?
That won't be in a footnote.
Okay, but Justice Resnick, this woman in this situation was not on equal footing. She gave in to him. She let him lead. And there were blocks of time when there was no attorney-client relationship in existence on a day-to-day basis. If he got a speeding ticket, she'd help him out pro bono. But the relationship, a large part of it, when it was going on, there was no lawyer-client existence. That blurs to an extent.
Counsel, the disciplinary counsel cites the, is it Cipriani case?
Yeah.
And I don't recall all the facts of that, but in terms of financial assistance and those kinds of things, factually seems, is that one of the closer cases factually?
Well, that was a 1 year with 6 months stay.
No, I mean the underlying facts.
There were similarities, yes.
Okay, and but the penalty was lighter than disciplinary counsel recommends here.
That 6 month.
It was 1 year, 6 months stay.
Right, but I'll tell you, there's a couple of important things there that I think are more aggravating than what we have here. In that case, the respondent, number one, he lied to a judge. Number two, he was convicted of a criminal offense. Those two significant aggravating elements do not exist with Ms. Krieger. She didn't lie under oath to anybody. Yes, she may have skirted the issues and danced a little bit when her employer spoke with her. But everything that has happened in this proceeding, when she's been under oath, she's been forthright. They've laid out the facts, and she said, yes. This happened, this happened, this happened.
Okay. The distinction that he drew, and that's, I think that's always a tough one for us to analyze. There is the opportunity to offer in mitigation the testimonials. An experienced lawyer with lots of friends, seemingly consistently in these cases, can bring in a lot of testimonials, including from judges. I don't think we should be discounting those, but there, it does seem that someone in that situation can probably generate a good deal more of those. And I guess I'm asking,
and
the absence of it here.
There's an explanation for that,
yeah.
Justice Pfeiffer. This young lady had her picture splashed in the newspapers and the television screens in our community. She was mortified. She couldn't go to people and ask them. She was so embarrassed that she was the one in people's living rooms and on the coffee tables in the mornings wearing the scarlet letter. She went to a few, and that was all she could do. I don't feel that padding the record with testimonials always means we should consider that as a significant difference in how we ultimately impose a sanction.
Is there another case that is closer than the Cipriol case, or is that the closest one in terms of the underlying?
Only four or five facts. Cases, and none of them squarely fit into what we have here today. We can take bits and pieces. I take different bits and pieces than Mr. Berger does in coming to what I feel is fashioning an appropriate sanction.
In any of those, are there any of them in which there was no timeout?
Yes, there was. Most specifically, in the Moore case, it was a 1 year, all of which was stayed. That was a case in which there were two victims, so to speak. There were inappropriate comments to one client. and separate, there was consensual meretricious behavior with another client. There was no significant harm to the client, and in that case, the attorney was the aggressor. So here we have an attorney who's not the aggressor, and all Moore got was a one-year stayed, if that.
And what was it that he did?
He did two things. One, he made some inappropriate comments to one client, and second, he had consensual sex with a client. And I think the court started with the argument there that if it's just consensual sex, public reprimand has always been the standard of the court between consenting adults. But because of the added element of the second client, where there were comments made that were inappropriate, I said, we're going to go, this court said, we're going a step further. It's 1 year stayed.
Was that the first in the succession of these cases? Because we have been, was that in chronological order? Was that the first one?
I don't recall the exact chronology, but they're all of relatively recent vintage in which the court is trying to refine parameters. It's a difficult case. It has been for me. It certainly has been for the respondent. Respondent is asking the court to follow the board's recommendation. She has been very contrite and apologetic. I'm not asking this court to feel sorry for the lady. She did wrong. She knows she did wrong. But I can't say this is a case where an actual suspension is appropriate. She's not taking advantage of a client in a jail cell. She's not been convicted of a crime. She's not lying to a judge in a courtroom. And those aggravating factors are things this court has pretty much established as a bit of a bright line test in whether you take the ticket or you don't. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shingold. Mr. Berger, you've saved 3 minutes of your time.
Respondent suggests that her only intentions towards Mr. Willoughby were to nurture and assist Mr. Willoughby. If respondent's only intentions were to nurture and assist, there would have been no need for the sexual relationship. There would have been no need for her to deceive her employer. There would have been no need for her to conceal her relationship from her husband and her children. Respondent suggests that the period of representation did not encompass the entire period of the relationship. The record in this matter shows respondent appeared in court on behalf of Willoughby in July, August, September, October, and December of 2003. This court previously was discussing the Moore case. There's two main differences between respondent's conduct and that of Moore. First, Moore was not accused of engaging in dishonesty or providing improper financial assistance. As such, respondent's misconduct is more extensive. Second, again, I point to the question of character evidence. This court placed great weight on the character evidence provided by Moore, which included the testimony of two judges and the local prosecutor, all of whom expressed unwavering support in Moore. Respondent engaged in a six-month sexual relationship with a client, provided financial assistance for 9 months to the tune of $8,000, engaged in dishonesty with her employer, continued this relationship after both an oral and written reprimand, enabled her client in his criminal activity by providing him with funds, knowing that he was addicted to cocaine, and this relationship only ended after the respondent was assaulted. Respondent has strayed far outside the boundaries of ethics and common sense. She's shown extremely poor judgment. She failed to act in the best interests of her client. She engaged in two clear conflicts of interest and dishonesty, all of which is aggravated by her dishonest and selfish motive and her resulting harm to Willoughby. As such, relator suggests an actual suspension from the practice of law is appropriate, and requests a 24-month suspension with 12 months stayed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.